Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast episode 82 for January 4th, 2011. My name is Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Ramier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
And this is our 2010 year in review episode. We will be going over some of the big stories and some of the not so big stories of this past year. Basically, what strikes us and what we see as the coming trends in technology and the law. So the first story that I'd like to mention is one that's been kind of ramping up steam throughout this entire year, and that's the series of patent lawsuits where pretty much all of the major players in the technology area are essentially suing each other for patent infringement over various patents, most of which relate to some sort of mobile platform. So Apple sued Motorola and HTC. I know Motorola has sued, I think they've sued Google and Microsoft, and there's just a flurry of lawsuits going back and forth.
Microsoft actually sued Motorola. So
Oh,
there's
okay.
Oracle and Google, Oracle and HP, Oracle and SAP, Oracle and NetApp.
Yeah, and a whole
So
string of countersuits in these cases. So I know
yeah.
after Moto I'm sorry, Apple sued HTC, HTC filed a countersuit and is alleging that Apple's infringing some of HTC's patents. What surprised me when these stories first started to break is that I had always assumed that there is most of the patents that people get in the tech industry are defensive patents. They are there to kind of put a stake in the ground and say, listen, I know that you other companies have patents that could totally ruin our business, but listen here, we in our arsenal we also have patents that could totally ruin your business. So let's just all sit on our patents and not sue each other and do license agreements when we think it's appropriate to do license agreements. Kind of a mutually assured destruction, you know. These are the nuclear armories of the various companies, but instead, and at this point, I can't even remember who fired the first shot. This entire system kind of collapsed when people started suing each other. And as of now, we really haven't seen any movement at all. I mean, there was the Paul Allen case that was dismissed with leave to refile, and Paul Allen has since refiled. But we really haven't seen any movement in these cases, and I wouldn't expect to for a while because there's going to be a whole lot of discovery. A whole lot of discovery, and eventually motions for summary judgment, if these cases get far enough. But was anybody else surprised that these companies finally pulled the trigger and actually filed these lawsuits as opposed to just sitting on their patents?
Definitely. I agree that there was sort of this defensive mindset that I won't sue you if you don't sue me, and we all have our patents. I'm not really sure what precipitated it. It's kind of maybe the competition of the mobile devices market itself was such that, I mean, the really interesting one, I think, out of all of this is the Java patents that Oracle has with Google. Basically, Oracle bought Sun, and Sun had licenses on Java and was the creator of Java. And Google used Java and this virtual machine in their Android platform, and that's a particularly interesting angle to take in that Oracle sort of Sun back in 1995 or so pioneered the whole thin client idea that you just need a computer connected to a network. You don't really need very much processing power or applications on the computer because everything will run on the network. And now Google is sort of doing that itself with Android and with a Chrome OS 15 years later. So it's interesting to see that they're basically fighting it out. And I guess there might be some bad blood there as well in terms of Sun sort of being a little perhaps premature with their idea, and actually Google now perhaps being at the right time for the thin client, sort of the rise of the thin client.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you point that out because Google does have the God, what is it, the CR48, their netbook that essentially runs in the cloud, and you keep on hearing this promise of everything's going to run in the cloud. And I mean, and that promise goes back to the dumb terminal days where I mean it did kind of run in the cloud if the cloud was a big server room in the back of your corporate headquarters, but. We went from people having computers on their desk to these thin, well, people having computers in giant rooms to these thin clients that actually, were, just kind of dumb terminals, and that we moved away to full computers on your desk, and now we're moving away again to, essentially dumb computers with everything in the cloud. Cloud computing, of course, being a new thing that really it gained a whole lot of steam this year, or at least the buzzword cloud computing did.
Yeah, the concept is actually old, although it wasn't as detached that the cloud computing was around, but you were wired to the cloud, I guess, back in the 80s and 70s. But I mean, to speak honestly, like Unix machines, they would have your entire profile saved so that whatever machine you logged into, it would load automatically from the network. It didn't really matter what client you were on because the network stored your profile. So every machine was just like your machine. And this was back in at least the 80s, if not the 70s. Although, again, it was all fully networked and not wireless.
Right. Any other thoughts on this big patent kerfuffle? I mean, the flow charts alone have been pretty staggering as far as what's going on here. And I mean, this is something we're gonna have to keep our eye on, but I would not be surprised if, it gets to the summary judgment phase, and right before summary judgment, most of these settle out somehow. I just cannot possibly fathom all of these going to trial or all of these really getting through discovery, because I mean, this is just going to be a hugely expensive process for everyone involved. And the only people who it's going to be good for, if it's going to be good for anyone, are the people who are already essentially out of the market and are just trying to bring these lawsuits as a last salvo to, recoup some of their, get some of their investors their money back.
The attorneys also will probably be very happy for the business.
Yeah, that's true. So the only people who are really going to make off in this are the attorneys. So, we're not knocking it, but
Yeah,
we're saying no one's going to come out a winner here.
flowcharts are pretty amusing. There's RIM suing Motorola, Microsoft suing Motorola and HTC, Apple suing HTC, Elan suing Apple, Apple suing Nokia, Qualcomm suing Nokia, Nokia suing Qualcomm, Nokia suing Samsung, Kodak suing Samsung, Kodak suing Sharp, RIM suing Sharp. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Like, it's crazy to think that 2 years ago none of these lawsuits existed. There was peace in the tech industry.
Also interesting, I think, is that these lawsuits are coming in a year where we saw the Bilski decision by the Supreme Court, and also we now have the Microsoft I for I case going up for arguments before the Supreme Court. And Bilski, of course, dealt with the statutory subject matter of patent law, and then the Microsoft I for I case looks like it might have some implications for the standards when courts are evaluating the validity of patents when it comes to lawsuits.
Yeah, the
Yeah,
I4I case is going to be pretty big. Go ahead, Ben.
I agree. I for I has the potential to be interesting. Let's not talk about Bilski though. Bilski was such a dud of a case. It
It
posed a
was.
very interesting question for the Supreme Court, essentially to take a new look at software patents. Software patents, I guess, kind of tangentially, but process patents in general, and kind of set a new stake in the ground as to, what is and is not patentable. And instead, they just kind of threw up their hands and said, "Well, this process isn't patentable because it's just an abstract idea, but we're going to leave everything else for another day." I mean, which, if you look at the way the case came out, and if you look at the, inside baseball as to who wrote the case and the split, it looks like they were trying to forge a path where they severely limited the scope of process patents and just could not get the votes for it, which is a little disappointing. But yeah, I mean, there's just so much build up for that case, and it was supposed to stand for so much, and it just kept on getting delayed and delayed and delayed until it was released on the very last day of the term, and I think it just kind of fizzled.
Definitely disappointing. But the I for I case, I think that's going to be an interesting battle to see.
I mean, I think you're right in that it has the potential to be interesting. We're going to probably see the first briefs in a couple of weeks in that case, and again, posing the interesting question to the court of whether or not the presumption of validity that patents have should stay where it is, should it be modified, should it be lowered. The Supreme Court could also come back and say, we like it the way it is, we're not going to do anything, and we'd have another potentially interesting case fizzle, just like the Omega case did.
So I think really quick to reiterate what exactly those points are at stake in that case. Right now, you need to present, if you're going to challenge the validity of a patent in court, a clear and convincing evidence that the patent is invalid. And what Microsoft is attempting to do is to have the Supreme Court say that that standard is too high and lower it down to a preponderance of the evidence, which is more like sort of like saying more likely than not, this patent should be invalid for the following reasons.
Right, but there was a little more nuance. The guys on IP Colloquium did a talk with one of the people representing Microsoft, I believe it is in this case. And their argument, and I didn't realize this at the time when we were covering it last, is a little more nuanced, which is that they're saying right now the presumption is broadly that the patent is valid and that has to be overcome by clear and convincing evidence. But there are cases where we know that certain information, like certain instances of prior art, were not before the examiner. So in those cases, if we're just looking at, the subset of the art that we know wasn't considered, can we lower the presumption there? Could we lower the presumption all around? So there is some nuance to their argument, but either way, I think it's a decent argument. The patent office is, well overworked, and there's not a lot of evidence that they do a particularly thorough job when it comes to examining. So this rather difficult presumption very well could be lowered. And another interesting point that was brought up in the IP colloquium talk was that if you lower the presumption, there's a better chance of a judge dismissing the case at a summary judgment phase as opposed to waiting until after trial to try to dispose of it. So you could help reduce the cost of patent lawsuits by doing this too.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think something like 170 startup and biotech companies signed a petition or some sort of joint statement that they didn't want the standard lower because they're afraid that if the standard is lowered, then their patents may become less valuable.
But aren't Google and Apple backing Microsoft in this?
Yeah, yes, all the big tech players are backing it because they don't really like other patents. Like the way the sort of the lay of the land in the tech industry is that the really big players, they don't really want to bother with tech patents because they just happily cross-license or just buy whoever owns the patent. The problem is, say someone doesn't want to sell, then they have to go through the problem of litigation and validating the patent. So if it was easier for them, that'd make it cheaper for them to use whatever invention that person came up with, either by invalidating their patent or just suing them so that they run out of money. The mid-sized players, like the startups and the biotech companies, they really, really care about their patents because their companies tend to be built around them, that they're their primary product, if you will. If they don't have their patent, they're entirely screwed. And they really want to make sure it's as hard as possible to invalidate the patent. And their argument is basically, well, if the patent office is doing its job, then these patents should be valid, otherwise they wouldn't be granted. You shouldn't lower the standard after a patent has been granted. After this company has been built on this existing standard, because that's going to potentially change our entire business model and really threaten the future of these companies, just because they've been built, they've gotten investments based on the existing standard, and if suddenly there's a, let's say that the standard is lowered and a bunch of patents are invalidated, because it's easier to invalidate them, you only need to show it's more likely than not, you don't need to have clear and convincing evidence, then even if that's a mistake in invalidation, those companies are going to go under.
Right, yeah, for a lot of big companies, these patents are just kind of nuisances, especially all the suits that come along with them. Let's not forget that massive, massive, massive infringement award against Apple that was racked up to somewhere like 1.8 billion for Apple alleged, well, the jury found that they infringed a patent on a displaying software. It was essentially CoverFlow, displaying items in a kind of flowing list with graphical representations. So, I mean, I think I pointed this out before. So $2 billion is less than 4% of Apple's cash on hand, but it's still a lot of money. It's not something that they'd want to deal with. And I'm sure if they could get that reduced or just get the suit thrown out, they'd much prefer that.
And any money lost is money lost, no matter what the dollar amount is in the end of the day, too. So I guess we'll have to keep our eyes then on some of these interesting patent trends, and I definitely a lot of these cases are going to take several years to play out if they do indeed go to trial, and I'm sure that we'll also see some of those settled out of court in the next couple of years. So I think we can move on then to some of the interesting stories we've heard about the DMCA and fair use and copyright-related topics this year. Kind of hard to pick a place to start. There have been quite a few cases that hit the headlines, as well as just stories about cease and desist letters. Probably some of the big ones concerning copyright and file sharing include both the Jamie Thomas Raschet case and the Joel Tenenbaum case. Those, of course, were two separate cases. Jamie Thomas Raschet, as you will recall, had originally a jury award $1.92 million to the RIAA, which then was reduced to about $50,000 by the judge on something called a remitter. And at that point, once you issue a remitter, the plaintiffs have an option either to accept the remitter or to have a new trial just on the issue of damages. They took the new trial just on damages, and quite recently, in the last couple of months, the new jury awarded $1.5 million to the RIAA. So not too much relief then for Jamie Thomas Raschet, and she's also in the middle of an appeal on the basis of that final ruling, I think. Then there's the Joel Tenenbaum case, which is actually which was tried here locally in Boston. Joel Tenenbaum was found liable for infringing approximately 30 or 31 songs. A verdict was originally $675,000. That too was reduced on remitter by Judge Nancy Gertner down to $67,500. And I think there is a appeal which is going on with regard to that reduction in damages, and there's also some interesting constitutional questions going on with that. Anything to add on either of these cases, guys?
I mean, I think go ahead.
You go, Dominic.
I was going to say the big thing in the latter case there, the Tenenbaum case, was his sort of revelation on the stand, I guess, that he had actually copied these files, right?
Yes, that was right. Part of the original trial in 2009. He was asked point blank by his attorney while he was on the stand if he had actually downloaded the songs. It was something to that effect, maybe not those exact words. And he admitted that, yes, I did in fact download the songs. That was a factual issue in the case originally, and he had claimed at some point in depositions that he wasn't the person sitting at the computer who actually downloaded the songs. It might have been, you know, one of his roommates or somebody else that was in the room. And when if you don't have the actual person on the, you know, that as the defendant in the lawsuit who actually clicked the download button or effectuated the download in some way, then he's not liable for a copyright infringement. It was somebody else's fault. That was their argument. But all that was sort of blown away by this one question by his own attorney on the stand. And that was the turning point in the case itself.
And then it's interesting to see how the defense sort of took it from there after basically that. I mean, what was their strategy? How did they react?
Kind of rolled over and gave up because, I mean, at that point, keep in mind that Charlie Nessen, who was representing Mr. Tenenbaum, had lost his fair use claims. I mean, there's just nothing left except to argue to the jury that the jury should award as little money as possible. The defense was in very, very, very bad shape at that point in time. But Judge Gertner decided to come in and, you know, kind of save them after the whole trial was over.
Actually, you know what? This was, I just take this to be a case that had bad facts, though it ended up being a small, I don't want to call it a victory, but at least for the broader issue of whether the statutory damages provisions in the Copyright Act are constitutional, that was what Judge Gertner left open in the remitter, and she, rather than reducing it on other grounds, she took sort of this constitutional route saying that the statutory damages provision doesn't really bear enough relation to the actual damages which were suffered by the plaintiffs in this particular case. That being that there was 31 songs that were at issue in the case, and how could you possibly relate $675,000 worth of damages to 31 songs? And so that's sort of what the constitutional issue that's left open in the case, and I think it will obviously be the subject of an appeal as well. So let's see, some other interesting cases this year. Viacom and YouTube, that case has been kicking around for the last 3 years. We finally saw a resolution, or at least a partial resolution of the case, in June 2010, so just over the summer. The District Court for the Southern District of New York awarded summary judgment to YouTube in the case, and this was all about whether YouTube should be held liable for copyright infringement, essentially contributory copyright infringement, for allowing users to upload and view hundreds of thousands of copyrighted materials that were owned by Viacom without Viacom's permission. The case was originally filed in 2007, and finally this particular issue was resolved this summer, and now there was almost actually immediately after the case was resolved on the motion, I believe Viacom filed an appeal, and we're starting to see amicus briefs be filed on behalf of both sides. So probably a few months before we get a final resolution before the Second Circuit.
Right, we've seen Viacom file their brief, which basically reiterated their brief below at summary judgment, raising essentially the same arguments. I guess, God, that was almost a month ago, so we should be seeing Google's brief relatively soon. And then, I'm not that familiar with the Second Circuit and how long it takes to get to an argument, but there'll be an argument, probably a lengthy oral argument, and then eventually an opinion from the Second Circuit.
Right, many months. So just to remind people what the key holdings were that the district court had, one of the arguments that Viacom had tried was that they had sent blanket takedown notices, basically saying one notice should cover under the DMCA the takedown of several hundred or several thousand songs. Of course, the court rejected that argument. Another argument that they tried was that general knowledge that there are infringing videos on the website is enough to hold the owner of the website liable for infringing content without any actual knowledge. And also that just that general knowledge doesn't necessarily impute actual knowledge, which is sort of the legal way of articulating the same thing there. And finally, I think the court also disposed of the issue of whether websites should be mandated to police content on behalf of the content providers. So YouTube does not necessarily have to police very carefully the content that Viacom actually owns.
What's interesting to see since 2007 is YouTube's implemented all these technological means of automatically detecting infringed content, automatically, for example, disabling sound on videos where it detects that there's a copyrighted song playing in the background, or to say audio has been disabled for this video. They've done a really good job in terms of technologically trying to clamp down on copyright infringement using cool stuff like basically trying to identify what song is playing. They've really tried. I mean, it's not like they're saying la la la, we see no evil, hear no evil. They've actually given a good effort, and I think that's really going to weigh for in their favor when it actually comes to a resolution.
Something that doesn't really seem to be clearly reported on some of the articles I've read on this case is that the case is really about things that happened prior to the when the lawsuit was filed, and that was filed in 2007. So you're completely right, Dominic. They have implemented all these great new ways of locating and sort of policing, even though there's no requirement to police infringing content. And word on the street also that they're very good about working with some of these content providers to, make sure that videos are taken down on time, expeditiously, as the DMCA requires. But this case is mostly about things that happened just after YouTube was acquired by Google, which I think that happened in 2005. So it's a sort of a narrow window of 2004, 2005, 2006, maybe, that is really the issue of this lawsuit.
Yeah. But
Let's see.
my point, I guess, was that their technological, the stuff they developed is going to, I mean, it's going to weigh in favor in terms of the, I guess, the sort of the, I don't want to say the intent, but the perspective that they were coming from, even in 2007, before they implemented the technological measures. Viacom's going to try to portray them as sort of a pirate's website where they made money off of people infringing on Viacom songs by putting ads next to the videos with the songs in them, and YouTube can say, well, no, we just didn't have the technology developed, we were actively working on it, now it's in place, we didn't have it then. Before we had the technology, it was completely impractical for us to hire thousands of people to go through all these videos. That would have been importantly expensive. Now that we have the technology, we do that, but back then we were still developing it. We couldn't afford to hire all those people, so there's really nothing we could have done. Do you see sort of the argument that I think they'll make?
Oh yeah, and I think actually it's a stronger argument than people give it weight, but I think it's a strong argument on the policy side, not on how the DMCA is currently worded in the statutory language. And that's what the district court seems to have focused on. We'll have to see what the Second Circuit does in this case and whether they really buy into that. But I mean, basically what the argument that Viacom is saying is like, hey, the way that YouTube got popular was because people were uploading infringing videos that we owned without permission, and that was driving a whole heck of a lot of traffic to the YouTube website. And not only that, the people at the time who owned YouTube were making a lot of money off of it. They were able to show these high traffic ratings, and they were able to successfully sell the website to Google for a substantial sum of money, in the billions of dollars. And we should, you know, we should be paid for the content that we own that was uploaded without our permission. It's sort of an interesting thing to say, and it's also directly opposed, or at least in the view of the district court, to the way the DMCA is currently worded and how the safe harbor provision should work.
There's also a set of emails, right, from the YouTube founders to each other,
Yeah, those are
basically,
the smoking gun
which are
email.
pretty bad.
Yeah, that and that sort of supports the Viacom argument that, you know, they had some sort of general awareness that the site was regularly being used by users to upload content that they did not own, and that was one of the principal factors that was driving the web traffic to YouTube. And then again, and that again, you know, relates back to the prior to 2007, sort of in this acquisition time period of where the ownership was changing hands from the people who founded YouTube to Google. And it, as far as I remember, I think it was mostly the some of the executives that were involved with YouTube back when it was more of a startup than when it was actually in Google's hands.
Yeah, but I think there were also emails back and forth within Google while Google still was doing Google Video before they acquired YouTube, basically saying, listen, YouTube's kicking our butt because they've got lots of infringing content and we're trying too hard to keep infringing content off. So, you know, there's also awareness that Google understood what was going on and that infringing content is what, you know, will be a principal draw of traffic. But I think more to the point, even if they, that YouTube had knowledge that there were some infringing videos, and even if they had knowledge that there were, you know, X number of infringing videos, that doesn't mean that they're liable for every infringing video that has ever been uploaded.
And now I think you've hit the weaker side of Viacom's argument. Certainly, that's the way it seemed that they were spinning this, is that, you know, you owe us money for all the infringing videos that have been uploaded to your website. And it seems a little bit ridiculous. And when you compare the arguments that Viacom is making back to the language in the DMCA, I think it's also a, you know, a difficult argument to make successfully before not only the district court, but potentially the Second Circuit.
Yeah, and I mean, I kind of gave Viacom's argument short shrift there because if YouTube had knowledge of these infringing materials and they did not act promptly to take them down, then they would lose their immunity under the DMCA. But I mean, I haven't seen these emails. I don't know if this general awareness. So the general awareness, the court said, is not sufficient to lose your DMCA immunity, and I don't think. I don't know if specific awareness of a video is enough to make you lose your DMCA immunity for all videos
Yeah,
or
I
all
don't think
content
that
in
it
content.
would be. I think you're right there. And the problem to me, though, is that even if you suspect that there is an infringing video that a user has uploaded, you don't actually know that it's infringing, that it's been posted or uploaded without authorization from the content owner, until the content owner tells you that that person had no authorization to do that. So it's sort of a, almost, I want to call it a due process problem, really. You need to have both sides have their say before you can say, oh yeah, that's definitely infringing, and it's also enough to give a person actual knowledge.
YouTube also makes users check a box basically saying that they have rights, so there's sort of a presumption that they do have the right until the content owner comes by and says, no, actually they don't.
Right, and plus Viacom actually uploaded a fair number of videos that were made to look like they were bootlegged and uploaded them from non-Viacom accounts, and Viacom later then went and sent takedown notices for things that had actually been legitimately uploaded by Viacom itself, let alone things that may have been legitimately uploaded by third parties.
I think there's definitely some very odd facts in the case about what Viacom was doing. It's sort of checking to see if YouTube was actually doing as they say that they were doing, and it just sounds like there was some shady dealing going on both sides, though. I mean, you have these smoking gun emails, which do not paint YouTube or Google in a good light, and then you also have these actions that Viacom did too. I don't know how much that actually plays into the case that they were doing these things maybe in bad faith. Does that really affect the requirements in the DMCA safe harbor? I don't know. It doesn't seem like it would affect it that strongly, but maybe that's something that the Second Circuit would weigh in passing. Any last thoughts?
I'm all set, and I think it's fair to say to our listeners that we will be covering this more and more and more as the as 2011 progresses.
So a couple other cases worth mentioning before we move on to some of the other interesting stories. We have the Lenz v. Universal case, also had a decision this year. Lenz v. Universal was, of course, also related to YouTube, but not YouTube was not a party in the case. Lenz, who was a mother, had posted a short picture, like a 27-second video or so, of her toddler dancing to the Prince song Let's Go Crazy, and it was very poor audio quality, sort of garbled. Then the copyright owners filed a DMCA takedown notice with YouTube, who then took down the video. And the problem here was one basically of fair use. You have a very short second of a video. I think it prominently displayed the guitar solo, but it was the baby dancing to the guitar solo in the song. You could hear some of the lyrics prior to when the solo kicked in, so you could identify it as the Prince song, and also the title of the video after it was uploaded was also labeled Let's Go Crazy, I think. But it's potentially a very strong case for fair use, and the case ended up being, and the EFF stepped in to help Lenz out. The case ended up being about whether the content owners have to take into account fair use before sending a takedown notice and having a video taken down. So essentially about some of the chilling effects that might occur because of DMCA takedown notices. And the district court agreed with the EFF and Lenz, and the case is also on appeal right now. Although there are some other issues remaining in the case, I think. There are also some interesting stories about Hitler downfall parodies and satires that we covered this year. If you are unfamiliar, there is a movie called Downfall, which is a bit about the Third Reich. There are some interesting scenes which have been taken that show Hitler getting really upset, and what people were doing were clipping the movie out of the actual work itself. There is a way to do that legally without breaking the CSS, I've read. And then they were replacing the subtitles, and the scenes were shot in German, so Hitler sort of going on this rant in German, and it had English subtitles. They were replacing the subtitles with other things that were pretty funny, everything from iPhone issues to political parodies and that sort of thing. There were some interesting questions, though, whether those uses were actually fair uses, and that sort of plays into the whole parody versus satire dichotomy with regard to copyright law and fair use. See, and finally, shifting gears a little bit, I think one of the other big stories this year, or big depending on how you look at it, was that Apple's iPhones were granted exemptions, or I should say the owners of iPhones were granted exemptions for jailbreaking their phones for the next 3 years. So, any thoughts on any of those stories, guys? Or any trends that you care to predict?
I'd like to see more devices get jailbreak exemptions next time around. 3 years from now, when the Copyright Office finally gets to reconsider the exemptions to the DMCA.
I think it's a
So,
trend that'll continue. That's a good thing, I think.
does it mean anything, I guess? Was Apple ever going to go after individual owners of iPhones for jailbreaking their phones?
I mean, I don't think so, but it's nice to know that it's legal to do so. I mean, it's not legal to make the software that does it or to distribute that software, but it's nice to know that it's legal to actually jailbreak your phone.
Yeah, plus, I mean, corporations wouldn't do it at all. Now they might potentially consider it, especially for special use cases. I can think of maybe perhaps in the medical profession or something like that.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. So, like as you pointed out, Ben, though, the exemptions don't apply to the people who make the software that you jailbreak your iPhone, and you're still prevented from distributing that software. So this is basically an exemption that only helps the people with the technical understanding of how to do that on their own. Essentially, you can only jailbreak your own phone. You can't help jailbreak somebody else's phone.
Right.
Right. I think it would also
Although
protect
it's
somebody
pretty
who
simple now.
downloads the software and uses that software to jailbreak their phone. It just doesn't protect the person who made the software and distributes it.
So it still leaves open the possibility that, you know, we would have to wait another 3 years before we get another we get more exemptions from the Copyright Office or have these ones renewed. And in that time period, what could happen is that Apple decides, hey, we really don't want people jailbreaking our iPhones. We know already that they don't exactly like it, and they could start going after the people who have websites up that, you know, offer jailbreaking software. It would seem to me that a lot of the people who jailbreak the iPhones might not be able to do it but for the availability of software to help them jailbreak their iPhones, but that's just an assumption I'm making. So, any other thoughts?
No, I think I'm all set. I mean, I'm sure we're missing some, you know, huge story of the year at this point, but I think we've done a good job recapping some of the major ones.
Let's see, before we close out the show, we could talk a little bit about the net neutrality stuff that's been kicking around, the FCC court cases.
Whatever, that's not important. So, I mean, one of the things that really sparked the net neutrality debate was the previously, the FCC had levied a fine against Comcast for slowing down traffic and issuing, God, I think it was disconnect packets, while to people who were using BitTorrent and other file sharing services. And Comcast accepted the fine with the caveat that they had the right to appeal it, and they appealed it. And the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the fine, saying that the FCC did not have power to essentially fine Comcast for violations of net neutrality, which was very interesting and kind of sparked off this whole debate as to, you know, how the FCC could or should go about regulating net neutrality.
This was a kick in the groin for the FCC, at least in terms of its net neutrality mandate. I think one of the more interesting things about this is that, you know, net neutrality isn't something that's new to the current presidential administration. As a matter of fact, back in 2007, when this was going on with Comcast, that was something that the FCC had started as part of the Bush administration, and that sort of carried over. So, sort of some interesting political stuff going on behind the scenes, I think, with new FCC rules coming out. And I think we'll talk about that in a little bit. But in terms of the Comcast case, you know, this was really about the statutory authority that Congress has given to the FCC, and the, you know, the whole key point to the ruling was that the FCC did not have the jurisdiction under that particular statute, under the Communications Act, mandate their neutral traffic over the networks that comprise the internet. Following that, though, the FCC announced, and that so the Comcast case was in April 2010, and just about a month later, in May, the chairman of the FCC, Julius Genachowski, announced that the FCC was intending to reclassify broadband internet access service providers and reclassify them under Title II of the Communications Act, which then would sort of solve the problem, I believe, that was before the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which is where the Comcast case was resolved. But I don't know that they ever actually reclassified. That certainly would have hit the headlines. I didn't see it anywhere. After that, a few days ago, even December 21st, the FCC announced new rules on net neutrality. They had a 200-page report that was published, and it drew a lot of criticism for some of the rules that they've decided that they want to implement. So, despite not reclassifying broadband transmissions as sort of a regulated common carrier service, they have gone forward anyway and created these new rules. So, there are some legal questions that are still kicking around. I think that it's almost unquestionable that this will turn into a court case, if not several court cases. Some of the people both on both sides, whether you were pro net neutrality or against net neutrality, had issues with the actual rules themselves. I don't know if you guys had a chance to read that over the holiday break. There were certainly some questions as to whether wireless devices would be included in the new rules, being like cell phones and the like. And there was a lot of questions left open as to what broadband internet access providers or the wired connections to the internet, what rules would actually be imposed on them.
My understanding was that wireless is exempt from that. Basically, what the FCC did is they rolled over and accepted what was it, Google and Verizon's joint proposal for net neutrality regulations, saying that We will regulate to some degree with room for reasonable discrimination, the wired internet, but leave wireless an open question for, further investigation. And I wasn't really clear as to how they were doing this, because if they didn't have the authority to regulate it before, how are they reclassifying, or under what authority are they promulgating these regulations that they now have authority to do it?
So I don't know either, and that's why I suspect that this will be heavily challenged in the coming months. And not only are people upset about the rules, but I'm not even really sure that they had the authority to do what they did.
Yeah, it kind of came out of nowhere.
Well, not quite out of nowhere. They have announced repeatedly now for the last 2 years that they have wanted to promulgate some new rules regarding net neutrality. The ones that they actually imposed on Comcast, I think, were not binding rules, but sort of more like guidelines. If they're not binding rules, it's just sort of a statement of how the FCC intends to impose their current regulations on people. And that was back in the 2007 era, and now this is a more formal rulemaking process that has occurred at the FCC. It went forward to a vote. It passed the vote. So, any predictions for net neutrality trends in 2011?
Liberals will continue to want them, libertarians will continue to be divided, and Republicans will continue not to want them. I mean, beyond that, I don't know what we can predict. The incoming Republican House of Representatives has vowed to fight net neutrality tooth and nail. The still Democratic Senate, I think, is, just marginally in favor of it, and Obama pledged to support net neutrality, but he's going to have limited ability to get any type of legislation through in the next 2 years. So legislatively, I really don't know what to expect. I think from a practical standpoint, we're going to see ISPs continue to push the borders of what people think is appropriate for ISPs to be doing, especially with regard to filtering and prioritization and paid prioritization of traffic, until somebody has the authority to push back, or to or consumers finally push back and say that we don't want this to happen anymore.
Yeah, following the appeal in April, it seemed to the court seemed to suggest that now ISPs are free to do whatever they like. They can engage in traffic shaping practices. They can charge websites for priority access to their customers should they so desire. So I'm still really torn on what's going to happen and if just the ISPs are going to continue to sort of abstain from those sorts of practices, or if we're going to start to hear more reports of traffic shaping going on where you can see it, and that's how the Comcast allegations came to light.
I mean, I tend to be the sort of person who usually advocates the free market perspective, but in the perspective of net neutrality, the problem really is a lot of the time there isn't a market at all because there's only one provider. For example, I live in Boston, and the only high-speed internet provider I can have is Comcast. Verizon doesn't serve me. There's absolutely no other option. So if Comcast wants to do something that I would disagree with in terms of traffic shaping, and I'd like to take my business elsewhere, I can't. I don't have that market power. I don't have that market option, which means that there isn't really a free market in terms of letting consumers decide by favoring ISPs that promote more net neutrality policies. In that case, it seems like without the free market actually operating, then to me it seems like that's a proper role for the government to step in and actually make sure that net neutrality can occur, because the internet was basically built on net neutrality. Like without it, we wouldn't be where we are today. The web would not have taken off had not Tim Berners-Lee back in the day basically made all the protocols free, and people and all the servers worldwide carried the packets without charging anyone money or asking people to chip in anything or anything like that, without like, oh, well, these are packets to the competing academic institution. We're not going to deliver them. None of that existed. And had it, the internet wouldn't have taken off. The reason the network is so strong is because, precisely because of the net neutrality that has occurred to this point. And I think it's slightly misguided to put that aside in exchange for effectively monopolistic cable companies and high-speed internet companies who have basically lobbyists working Congress pretty well. It's short-sighted to put all that goodwill aside just for short-sighted profits. That's my little
Understandable.
spiel.
Another interesting part to the story, I guess, is that I believe the Comcast and NBC have gotten the green light for their merger. I'm not really sure if that's a merger of equals or just an acquisition from one party or another, but it looks like we will be seeing a new Comcast NBC should everything go according to plan. People will certainly be looking with a lot of scrutiny at the new NBC Comcast combination.
Doesn't GE own NBC, or did that change, or?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, and I guess GE is selling NBC. I don't know the details of that. Comcast is not buying GE.
Would imagine they'd be able to.
Yeah. So last I had heard is that it was going to get the approval, but the FCC was going to put terms that Comcast couldn't screw with people's streaming video on the internet if they want the merger to go through. So that would be nice if that was actually the case.
Do you mean the FTC?
I saw it listed as the FCC, but it probably was the FTC because I don't know if the FCC. Well, the FCC would have some jurisdiction over this because they'd be able to put conditions on the sale of the broadcasting company to Comcast. So it may in fact be the FCC.
Interesting legal question to see if that applies just to the broadcast services that NBC is engaged in, or if that also applies to the broadband aspects of what Comcast offers, considering there seem to be some open issues, as we just discussed, about whether the FCC has the authority to regulate that particular area.
Okay, we've kind of gone over our allotted 45-minute slot, so unless anybody else has something big that they want to cover, Dominic?
All set here.
David O'Brien.
I think I'm good.
Okay, in that case, we would like to thank you for joining us in this, the 82nd episode of the Technically Legal Podcast. As always, you can visit us on the web, www.technicallylegal.org. Email us your comments, suggestions, story ideas to podcast@technicallylegal.org, or follow us on Twitter @TechLegal. Signing off, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Grady.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for joining us.
Happy New Year.